Currently, I'm a co-director of Berkeley's Educators for Equity and Excellence program. It's the teacher education program at UC Berkeley. So I am a full-time lecturer there, and I teach the Social Foundations course, a secondary curriculum design course, and I am the lead for the MA workshop component of the program, and I co-teach the year-long practicum with a secondary practicum. And before that, I was lecturing for a year at Stanford, San Francisco State, and USF. That's how I met Rick, was through USF work. And then before that, and while I was doing that also, I was doing doctoral work at Stanford that I started in 2013. And before that, I was a teacher in San Francisco at a project-based alternative continuation school. So a school for kids who were kind of critically behind on credits and had essentially been discarded by the broader secondary system.
Yeah, I saw that. I actually did some work for a couple of years at his Civic Center. I saw that you were at Downtown Prep.
Yeah, so we had a lot of kids after they transitioned out of Civic Center, they would come to us. So, know Civic Center pretty well.
And sorry, just did you say that you're exclusively at Cal and not at Stanford or USF? Okay. All right, great. Well, you sound like a busy guy with a lot of incredible background, which we'll tap into today. So let me just kind of put out a little context so you know where I'm coming from and where the show is coming from, and then I'll kind of jump into the interview. Rick had suggested initially that I talk to you about alternative ways of teaching in the pandemic. We were talking about the kind of very narrow way the mainstream is framing the difference. It's either online instruction or traditional in-class instruction, and he said you were really good about alternative ways of thinking about that. But then I was really excited when I saw your background about continuation education, because that is an area where I've spent a very good part of my education career, and as you well know, it's really the cutting edge of where the educational system has failed, or maybe where it's succeeded in doing what it's designed to do, reproducing the relationships of power, privilege, and success, based on race, class, and gender. So that's another piece I want to explore in the interview. And the other thing to know is that, just to contextualize that, this is part of a series, and the series is really looking at the battle for the future of public education between the sort of corporatized neoliberal education agenda on the one side and the social justice paradigm on the other. And we're particularly focusing in on how that battle is being impacted and shaped by the pandemic. So that on the one side, the pandemic is being used to push a lot of long-time neoliberal goals like more online instruction, or narratives like blaming teachers and unions for educational failure. And then on the other hand, we have the massive failure of all of the major capitalist institutions, from, a lack of a good healthcare system to manage the pandemic, intensified white supremacist policing, growing racialized wealth gap, all these things that have opened up for many people to question everything about the system we live in, including education, and to consider what seemed like previously unimaginable possibilities not too long ago. So that's kind of the context for where we're going in the show, and this and other ones. So let me just kind of stop there and see if you have any questions before we formally start.
No, I don't. So yeah, I listened to the series that you linked.
Okay, cool. So you know where we're coming from. Okay, cool. All right. So let me start then by welcoming you, Kyle Beckham, to COVID Race and Democracy. Can you please introduce yourself and tell us what is most important for the listening audience to know about you?
My name's Kyle Beckham. I am a lecturer and co-director at Berkeley Educators for Equity and Excellence, BE3. It is the teacher education program at UC Berkeley. Before that, I did doctoral work on alternative schools, particularly continuation schools in California. And before that, I was a high school teacher in the Bay Area for 10 years, largely in continuation school, and in a school that was committed to really pushing alternative methods to teaching kids who had largely been discarded by the system through a project-based, a deep, deep project-based model. So I've been all of my professional adult life involved in schools. It's kind of what I live and breathe. While I was doing work at the continuation school, I also, at the district level, was part of a cooperative of teachers that helped establish San Francisco's ethnic studies program. So I continue to be involved less directly in that work, but still involved in it.
Can you define for us, when you talk about continuation schools or continuation education, that is terminology that's used legally and extensively in California, but not necessarily around the country where a lot of our listeners live. So can you define for us what you mean by continuation schools or continuation education?
Yeah, so in California, the continuation school system broadly would be what we think of as the alternative school systems in other states. And I like to think of alternative schooling sponsored by the state kind of as a continuum of, you have alternative schools for kids that the state wants to kind of foster their development, and you have alternative schools for kids that the system has not been able to sufficiently educate or convince that the project of state-sponsored education is worth their time. And the continuation school system in California, it's the largest in the country. Upwards of 100,000 kids kind of go through it in any given year. And it's for kids who are kind of critically behind on their credits towards graduating. Most continuation schools, and I would probably argue most alternative schools, those that are given that label, are pretty grim places where they're just kind of warehouses for kids that teachers don't want to teach and school districts don't want to invest in. And the investment is usually kind of done in such a way that it's, kids are given the option of, we will kind of cool you out and hold you until you age out of the system. We'll either try to minimally rehabilitate you, usually through giving you, redirecting you towards some kind of low-end technical or service work. Or for a select few of kids, giving them the option to be kind of more fully rehabilitated, either through completing at the alternative slash continuation space, where you would then kind of be ready for a community college, or re-entry back into your sending school, the school that failed you into the continuation system. So some variant of that exists in every state. And it's kind of one of these things that everyone knows about, but very few know the details of how it actually works. And, you know, some non-insubstantial number of kids are cycled through these systems every year.
That relates sort of to the larger question about how success and failure are defined. You know, as you alluded to, continuation education is seen by a lot of people as being for students who have failed in school rather than as for students who have been failed by the education system. And some of us would say it's not educational system failure, but the system is succeeding in doing exactly what it's designed to do, to systematically reproduce the patterns of who has power, privilege, and success in this country and who does not. So it's not a coincidence that continuation schools and a lot of our alternative schools are largely filled with students of color from low-income families and communities. What do you think about the ways that educational success and failure have been designed in this country? And if we were operating from a lens of educational equity or social justice, how might we define educational success and failure differently?
Well, so the American school system is fundamentally a competitive system. It's a brutal system. And what we have kind of understood is that the way that we're going to allow access to a highly segmented labor market is to put kids through a gauntlet. You know, we'll take the people with the, you know, arguably the fewest rights, and force them to participate in a system where the rewards are you get to have access as an adult to kind of privileged work. And that's been the foundation since we rolled out kind of mass schooling as a project, that the sorting function of schools has been, you know, it's the air that schools breathe. It's the normal. We have, you know, highly standardized systems of grades to sort people out. We don't know what an A between one class and another means, but we pretend that we do. We have ways of essentially conditioning kids to signal that they are compliant with relatively or not relatively authoritarian structures of schooling. That if you comply with what school asks you to do, you're rewarded and you're given access to higher levels of educational and thus material stability in your adult life. If you don't comply, then what ends up happening is that you're punished relentlessly to the point where you will be at least temporarily or permanently exited from kind of the mainstream mass project of schooling. And it's a highly evolved system. It's very efficient at what it does in terms of sorting kids out. And what it has done also is really facilitated an anti-solidaristic mentality within schools where students and teachers do not necessarily see themselves in a cooperative relationship, and students don't see themselves as kind of fellow travelers in a journey. Learning is highly ancillary to the project, and one only need to look back on your own life usually to say, like, what did I actually learn in school? And it's sad, but most people probably struggle mightily to recall many things related to the formal curriculum. So there's a lot of teaching that's happening that has nothing to do with the curriculum itself. It's everything to do with kind of the social teaching, the hidden curriculum. And that hidden curriculum is highly racialized. It's highly a space for downward moving class warfare in which upper and middle class folks have a kind of war of values on working class people. But I think the big tragedy is that schooling is largely a place where learning is not the central thing, even though we say that's the central project. There's a far deeper and I would argue more sinister project, which is one of social mobility, of social reproduction, and of breaking kind of what I would say is like our natural inclinations towards solidarity and community, of working together to solve problems and learn from one another. Schools have been exceedingly well engineered to break those bonds.
Can you say a little more about that engineering? I think you mentioned the grading policy, but what are some of the policies and practices, whether it's grading or college admissions or standardized testing curriculum, what are some of the mechanisms built into the system to create that sorting function of winners and losers by race, class, and gender?
We kind of have to go back to the foundations of, again, the project of mass schooling. As America began to urbanize, industrialize, and centralize, we have more and more institutions that kind of reflect that pattern. And the foundations, the beginning points, are where a lot of these things that we take for granted in schools were set. And so the projects of mass schooling came about in an era of eugenics. And when you think of the things that we take for granted in schools, like age grading, there's nothing intrinsic about putting all kids together just because they're the same age. It's just a project of efficiency, and it makes it easy for adults to do the work of sorting. Sorting is just seen as a natural thing that we do, again, rooted in a eugenic kind of hierarchical ordering of society in which there will be those who do the work of the mind, those that will do the work of handwork, and, you know, a vast middle that will do something in between. And that high school, for example, is one of these things that, if you look at the history of high school, it initially was designed specifically to root people out, to turn them away. It reflected the class, race, and gender biases of those who had the power to establish it as a normative institution. And of course, you know, in the 19-teens and 20s and 30s, as mass schooling evolves, it was not a democratic project. It was one rooted in the exclusion of vast, vast numbers of people along those axes I just mentioned around class, gender, race, ethnicity. The centrality of ethnicity has declined and been substituted with the centrality, or not substituted, but kind of race has become more prominent. But if you look at the early foundations of urban schooling, it was to Americanize and flatten white difference, to take the white ethnic and make them white. And that invariably is a project that's closed automatically to groups of color. And so you have that, and that's the foundation. The foundation is not one of maximal inclusion. And that's not because people didn't try to fight. There was a long struggle between the managerial or industrial progressives and people like John Dewey and people who were inspired by John Dewey. And the people who won were the managerial progressives. They set the kind of structure of schooling. And we take these things as inevitable. We take the hierarchical structure of the classroom as inevitable, the hierarchical structure of the school itself as inevitable. We have even internalized the belief that one's racial identity is what can make one fail in school, rather than the practices, structures, behaviors of those with power in school are the reasons why Black children tend to be failed more in school, or Latino children tend to be failed more in school, or why poor children of all races tend to be failed more, is because of these biases built into the very beginning. And continuation and alternative education as the requirements for kids to be in school longer, another thing that we take for granted, is this thing that we're just, all kids are in school until they're 18. That is very much a post-World War II project, which we think of as an inevitable feature. Well, and that was to keep young people out of the labor market. But what about young people who still want to go into the labor market and we have forced to go into schools? We need a place to keep them. And so out of that emerges a vast network of alternative schools to do that. And when they were formed, you know, there were kernels of difference, of actually being alternative. And now what we see is largely like alternative is simply smaller places that are either just straight warehouses, or they're populated by teachers who tend to kind of care a little bit more about the kids who've been discarded, but they don't approach the work of teaching and learning in an alternative way. It's simply smaller schools with more care, and that's an alternative. And what we could have is like real radical alternatives. They exist, but they're largely private. They're for those who can pay for them. And the larger structure just continues to march on. The things that we label as alternative, we can't really even think of like what makes them alternative other than that the kids in them have been failed by the system.
And let's talk more about that. So if we were about creating more equitable and socially just alternatives to the educational practices and policies we currently have, what would that look like? What are some of the key features that might include?
What's so interesting is that, you know, we've known for quite a long time the things that work well. But those things are expensive, they're time intensive, and they run counter to that large mass project of kind of centralized, highly controlled by a, you know, very small elite minority. What works is generally inefficient. What works is getting rid of grades, of having apprentice-like relationships between teachers and students, where teachers are sometimes being apprenticed by their students. We know that the best way to evaluate someone is not via a standardized test or a quiz or all of these other things that we know via schooling, but, you know, via projects, via longitudinal things that people are working on that are reflective of their own interests. Getting out of the school as building, going into the world itself. These are the things that we know work in terms of building real deep, lasting learning. Personally, so I was at a school where we organized to really be an alternative. We wanted to be something different for these kids who had been just kind of brutalized by regular old schooling. We had two teachers who would form a project that the kids could choose from one of six projects every semester. I co-taught a project called Physics Reflected in Social Movements. So for a whole semester, we would do projects like my co-teacher, who was the math and science specialist, would teach the kids kind of basic Newtonian mechanics. And then what I would do is use those concepts as like metaphors for social movements. And we would do things like look at the history of hip hop and I would have graffiti artists and DJs and MCs and poets come in and then co-create work with the kids. And then at the end of the semester, what would we do? We would share it with the school community, invite people in. Other projects have the kids going out into the community doing habitat restoration, going to state parks, learning about the geology of the places that they live on, learning about the indigenous communities who were and still are here, but what life for them was and is like, to give the kids a deeper sense of place. So these are things that would not are offered to rich kids. And we're like, we're not gonna just do that. We're gonna give this to the kids who deserve it the most, because they're the last in line to get these kinds of things, because everyone has quit on them. No one thinks that they're gonna appreciate it. And for the kids that had some kind of modicum of outside of school social stability, they thrived. They had real experiences that were meaningful for them. They created things that they were proud of. They did photography. They could talk about art. They could do all of these wonderful things because we created the conditions for them to do it. We as a school said, we're not going to do testing. We're not going to teach history in this like linear way. We're not going to do master narrative stuff. We're going to do something different, something that makes us as teachers feel passionate, makes us want to come to school every day, and makes the kids want to come to school, so that we don't have to rely on the cudgels of grades and the threats of you're going to lose XYZ if you don't come. You know, and there's some of that, but it was greatly reduced. And, you know, you would have kids that would stay at school until late at night, kids who throughout their high school histories have been, you know, 50% attenders. They're 85, 90% attenders because we worked hard to create these kinds of conditions. And we know these things. We see them. Rich people seem to know about them, and they seek them out and they pay for them. We know that outdoor education is a great thing, and we blew it in the pandemic. We had this great opportunity to get kids out of their houses safely, to go and explore the world behind them in Zoom, to ask them to look behind them. Let's go out and safely explore outside. Let's learn about our environments. These are things that we know work, and we just didn't do it. We quit. Instead, what we ended up doing was saying, we're going to do regular school on Zoom. And when it didn't work, everyone was like, well, it didn't work. It must be distance. I don't think it was distance. I think it was simply mapping on the pre-existing paradigm onto Zoom. So it took what was not working and made it even worse. And that's not to say that there aren't really creative alternative approaches that teachers have been forced to adapt, but there's still this kernel of, we have to continue doing school as before, pretending that it was working before for vast numbers of kids. And it doesn't. Most kids are wildly ambivalent about school, especially in high school as they get older. They could take it or leave it. Little kids are a little more willing to work with us adults, but older kids, they don't like going to school for non-social reasons, vast numbers of them. There's the kids who do, right, which is probably 10 or 15%. And then there's the kids who are kind of explicit about hating it. And then there's this overwhelming middle that goes because they don't have something else to do, but they're not thrilled to be there. And they just kind of go through the motions. And that's a terrible kind of system to me, because it's just such wasted potential and wasted ways that we could be organizing time for us as teachers and for them as young people. They should be excited to go to school. And we know how to do these things, or we should be thinking more about how to do these things, and we just don't.
That is so powerful, and there is so much you said there that I want to unpack. You know, I think to go back a little bit to your example of your own experience in terms of project-based learning and getting students out into the community, which very much mirrored my own experience in continuation school education, one of the pushbacks was, well, but what are you going to do about grading? Like, how are we going to know that students really learned what they needed to know? And if you're not going to give them grades, then how are they going to be able to go on after high school and all those kinds of questions? So how did you handle the issue of assessing the students, what students learned, what their progress was, and then preparing them for those who wanted to go on into a traditional college system, satisfying the requirements that were needed to do that?
So it's complicated, right? Part of what we would do is that we kind of had a mastery model where we were very clear on what the kids needed to do in order to kind of demonstrate minimal competence or beyond minimal competence. We worked on that as a school community. And then what we did is that we kind of designed our teaching around the core instructional bins, right? So the core curriculum is usually you have an English language arts, a math, a science, a history, and some electives. So we would kind of do these projects that integrated all of these aspects so that we could say, like, okay, we're giving you your math here. It's focused on this semester. We would do fewer topics. That was the other thing. There's this belief in American education that more is always better and faster is always better. And it just is not. And again, I challenge most people to be like, what do you recall from any standardized test you ever took? Can you recall one question? I doubt it. And that shows that these aren't great assessments, but I know I could ask students that I taught 10 years ago, what do you remember about your final exhibition? What do you remember about when we had debate? You did debate around a core issue in front of the whole school. What do you remember from that? And they can tell me things. And so we worked really hard to make sure that there was some alignment, but then there were things that we just jettisoned because, again, I don't think that if we just say we march through this stuff, then the kids are prepared. There's a lot of evidence that marching through a lot of stuff, just because we cover it, doesn't mean they learn it. And that's even for kids who are doing really well at a school like Lowell, where everybody is supposedly such a great student. You know, I doubt that much of what they are supposedly learning is very sticky learning. So that's one of the things that we did is that we just made a decision that we're going to do less deeper because we care about the learning. And we were very clear on what the learning looked like. And if the kids weren't doing that, we gave them opportunities to revise, to try again. So one of the things that we did at our school is we had a kind of a theory of literacy at the school where we each semester we would read a book as in each class, each project had its own class book for the semester. And what did we do? We read the book in class every day and we made copies of the books for the kids and we taught them how to annotate, how to talk about text, how to read a text slowly and deeply, how to talk about it with others. And then we taught them how to write about what they've read. We weren't doing it so to prepare them for college, but invariably that kind of thing did prepare them for college. Those kinds of ways of reading, of writing. So again, slowing down and doing less actually was better preparation than marching through an almost infinite amount of other kind of curriculum. And you know, I see that in math education in particular, there's this belief that if we don't get through all of this curriculum, then the kids aren't going to be prepared. Well, there's lots of evidence that teachers can march the class through all of this content, all of this curriculum, and they don't learn anything. And then we pat ourselves on the back and we say, good job, we got through the curriculum. And kids go on to the next level. They may have even passed the class and aced all the tests, but they don't actually remember much of what they've learned and couldn't tell you much of what they learned or why any kind of math problem can be executed in a particular way. It's just get through it as fast as we can. And who's that for? I think it's part of this like race logic that we have of everything's a race and everything is a competition and these other countries are gonna beat us. And how brutal of a society is that we could tell a 7-year-old that if you don't do well on this test, some kid in another country is gonna take your lunch, which is just a foul lie. And we tell it. And we tell it like with verve and zeal, and we tell it at a mass scale. And it does a lot of antisocial conditioning to our kids. And it teaches them the wrong things about what learning actually requires.
That's deep and so true. And talking about the curriculum, can you address that one of the reasons that kids forget the curriculum is that it's actually not culturally relevant or personally relevant to their own lives and experiences and communities. So can you say a little more about the kind of culturally relevant or not curriculum and just what that curriculum does and doesn't really reflect?
I'm just more of a fan of just responsive curricula in general. Personally, I have some issues with the way that culturally responsive curriculum is framed, in that it generally is like, this is the stuff that you would give your Black and brown kids because they have culture. And there's a converse to it that also, you know, there are cultural groupings and formations that I don't actually want to sustain or be responsive to. That if there's, you know, kind of what I would view as extremely conservative or reactionary cultural values, I don't necessarily want to sustain those kinds of things. But there's a way to be responsive to the interests of kids of any given classroom community that I think can allow for a lot of the things that culturally responsive pedagogy intends, while still kind of respecting the internal diversity, the beautiful diversity within, you know, groups that we mark as culturally diverse. You know, I'm Black. I don't want to assume that my interests are the same interests as my Black students. I would rather want to learn about them, learn from them, and respond to what it is that they would like to know, more than me being the one that says, like, this is you, this is your history, you have to learn these things because this is your culture. Because there's something that's, I think, lost when we do that. And I really like when spaces are created for Black nerds and Black weirdos, not just, you know, I'm just speaking about Black people, to really emerge to say, like, they like anime, or they like these things that we don't think of as traditionally Black. But that to me is relevant and responsive. And that's what they need to thrive. And out of that, I think, comes like a much more solidaristic and there's so much more exchange and discussion and stereotype destruction, I think, when you create a space where kids can be their whole selves. You can be your whole self as a teacher. And that you're working on projects where you're all constantly learning from each other. You're learning from your local history, the big, larger histories. Not just your own, but those in the class as well. And you create space for everyone to kind of bring story. But also, sometimes you're going to have conflict where people are going to have to get pushed in directions where they may have never thought they were going to go. But how do we also create the conditions where those conflicts can emerge safely and kids can grow, hopefully in a more humane, solidaristic, and communal way? I think that that's the root of a lot of what responsive teaching really is. It's about fostering the maximal potential of individuals and groups. So that's one aspect of responsive teaching. But I think, like, also really working hard to allow for the students to have as much voice in where the curriculum goes or how the classroom is structured, and to invite as much of the community into the classroom as possible, and to go into the community outside of the school. And this is broad, right? Like, this is taking kids to places they wouldn't go, they haven't been, and making them feel like they belong in these places. So an example in San Francisco would be to take kids who've never been to Ocean Beach to go to Ocean Beach and say, this belongs to you. This is yours as much as it is anyone else's, right? It's all of ours. And you have a right to it. And really, I think that that's responsive too. That's a responsiveness I wish more of us took, is teaching kids like what is theirs in common with others, and that they have a right to go and make meaning out of these things that are all around them.
Appreciate that. I want to go back to another point you raised, which I thought was really important, about the sort of blowing the opportunity in the pandemic. If you pick up the newspaper these days, the hottest debate about education, you know, in the mainstream media is this question of, you know, online instruction versus in-person education, and a lot of it is framed around, you know, on the one side, there's the limitations of relying exclusively on long-term online instruction versus the safety risks of reopening schools and classrooms during the pandemic. And in the best of those debates, people will raise some of the questions of educational equity, who's actually being served and who's not by online versus in-person instruction. But the broader paradigm just is not really questioned, as you brought up. So what thoughts do you have about the way this whole debate is being framed in the pandemic about online versus in-person instruction?
So I really feel like it's a false dichotomy. I actually don't believe that in-person is always better. I mean, that is kind of an absurd statement that our own lived experiences should teach us is not the case. That being so bored in a class that you fall asleep, being so disconnected from peers that people become suicidal. You know, there's this this jump that I've also noticed that, like, all of a sudden we care about students' mental health and well-being so much, but there was an epidemic of student mental health crisis before the pandemic. We had in Palo Alto, suicides year after year here in San Francisco at Lowell High School, suicides and suicide attempts before the pandemic at these like really high performing schools. And so us rushing to go back to in-person without kind of setting the conditions for a safe return, not just the physical safety, but the mental safety, that's just kind of been brushed aside now. We didn't have the apparatus to do mental health really well in schools before. And where are the resources now? There's that. And then there's just this a priori belief offered without any evidence that online is always inferior to in-person. And I have seen great online teaching. I supervise teacher candidates, people who are at the beginning of their careers, doing wonderful things with kids. Wonderful. Would they maybe do better in person? Okay, sure. But what they're doing versus a lot of other people who are in person is like way, way better. And there's new ways that they communicate with parents. There's new ways that they even communicate with the kids. I don't want to say that it's always inferior. And it is for some kids and it is not for others. It's complicated, just like in-person teaching is. But the flattening of the narrative is really troubling, because what it ends up doing is it makes us romantic about the way schools were before the pandemic. And the way schools were before the pandemic were frequently very brutal, nasty places full of hierarchy, full of competition, full of kids bullying one another, and teachers, staff, adults, people on the outside of the school, turning away from that, pretending it wasn't happening. This happens, and we all can, again, us adults can mine our own experiences and think of like some of the really nasty things that happened in person that aren't happening now because kids aren't together and they're not in this hyper-competitive everyday space where the hierarchy is so clearly apparent. And so we need to be thinking about how can we maximize online, because online is going to be here to stay. There's going to be some not insignificant number of kids who cannot safely return, right? And that kid vaccines are, maybe we'll have them in 2022. So we have to be thinking about how can we be creative? How can we leverage the affordances that online gives us, and how can we minimize its weaknesses? But we should also be doing that for in-person, because the very physical limitations necessary for safety preclude many of the things that we know build lasting relationships, lasting learning, and kind of make school worth going to. The close interactions with one's peers or the teacher coming up to the table. Now, what do we have? We have kids isolated, rooted to one space, lectured at. Or what they end up doing is taking computers, putting them on the table, and doing online learning in the classroom. So we really have to be rethinking all of this. And when people make these claims, we need to say, what is your evidence that in person is better? where are you actually getting that? Because there's a lot of leveraging of that word evidence. And when it comes to the in-person versus online, we actually don't know right now. And we don't know that sending kids to school under these conditions is actually good for them. And or is it some mix? Like, I like to think it's probably some mix, but it's not as easy as we want to think of it. And another consequence of all of this is that this is probably one of the most brutal work speed-ups for teachers in the history of the profession. We're going to see teachers quit on a huge scale because instead of protecting the profession and thinking longer term, we've gone so radically short term because we have a absolutely non-existent social safety net that teachers are supposed to fix everything. And when they can't, they get blamed. It's a lose-lose situation no matter what you do as a teacher. Teachers are working their butts off. Teaching online is not easy, and they're getting no respect for it. And so what happens, another thing about the pandemic is that it makes it seem like there's just armies of people ready to be teachers. There was a massive, massive teacher recruitment gap. It was terrible. We could not keep and retain teachers. And these conditions aren't going to make, who wants to become a teacher now? And we're not thinking about in, let's say, when we get the pandemic under control, but how terrible a school is when you have three teachers absent and then you call for a substitute or three substitutes and only one of them shows up. What that does to a school. Or for schools that will have whole semesters or whole years taught by substitute teachers, what that will do. Because we burned out the full-timers, the long-termers, they quit. And that will do more damage than this 1 year of online, even if it's as bad as everyone says it is. That will do more damage than this year. And we don't even entertain that possibility.
That's so true. Not only are teachers not appreciated, but you know, as you alluded to, it's the opposite. It's those teachers and their unions that are preventing kids from getting an education now. That's the narrative. So let's go back. You mentioned, I was interested in hearing more when you talked about a number of teachers you've seen who've been doing amazing things with online instruction during the pandemic. Can you say a little bit more about what that looks like?
Yeah, so I work primarily with teacher candidates, right? Like people who are student teachers. And what they've been able to do is they've created consistent routines. They've worked with families to get them technology. But they've also really been able to connect with their students via the technology in ways that I don't think they would have before. They get to see the kids, you know, their faces every day. They get to actually create community, to create ritual, to do these things that their kids frequently look forward to, of morning meeting online, of sharing stories that the kids write, of giving, you know, intensive support with kids in a breakout room. These are the things that really have sustained kids, that kids show up. It's uneven, right? Because there's a lot happening outside of this schooling context that interrupts kids. But I think that the consistency, the care, the effort that these student teachers are putting into thinking about their teaching, and they're being forced to be creative in ways that they wouldn't have to be as creative if they were in person. You have to really think about, how can I hook my kids? How can I support my kids? How am I checking in with their families? Those things can get lost. And you have teachers that are, you know, asking kids to look in their homes, right? The kids who cannot go outside. Look in your homes, bring things from your house to the camera, and let's learn about these things. Let's make the home an adventure space where we can ask questions and learn about these things that we take for granted. Let's go talk to our older siblings. Let's involve them in the classroom and learn from them. Or let's get out. Go out and do something in the community safely. Go on a scavenger hunt. go to this place and take a picture of it, or go find something beautiful in your community and bring it back and share it with all of us. Things that normally would not have happened if we were just in person in that classroom, in that school building. Those things are happening because this has forced people to be creative. You know, there's a converse to it too, which is that those who can't be as creative double down on kind of control and punishment. Not the teachers that I work with, but the stories of like dress codes online and, you know, the draconian impulse to force kids to participate. That's there too, but that was there before. But there's a lot of new, interesting things that I think will, you know, I like to think that teachers, the good teachers, will take the best of this distance context. And then when they're back in person, they're going to use that to be even better teachers, to make their curriculum more accessible, to make the communication with parents and community members more consistent, to think of more ways to open up the classroom itself by not being intimidated by having a camera in your classroom and letting people watch. There's a lot of positive things too. It's not this all terrible hell space that, you know, the meta narrative has led us to believe. You know, for a lot of really isolated kids, the online school space is a safe space. It is a place for them to kind of escape into when it's well-structured, when they have regular interactions with peers and teachers who really value what they have to say. That's mental health sustaining also. So that's what we have to be thinking about too, is what are teachers doing to mitigate some of this stuff outside of the, in the community, in the isolated world of pandemic life, that school, online schooling has been a lifeline for a lot of kids. It has been a place of consistency and care. And that counts for something. And we should be saying that as well, because it honors the work that teachers have been and continue to be doing under unbelievably difficult conditions.
Thank you for that. I want to kind of zoom out a little bit at the broader picture, because you've given us a lot of good examples of individual teachers who are doing more creative and responsive to students kinds of instruction. But could you give us any examples where entire schools or entire districts are actually implementing some of these more equitable and socially just approaches to education? Does that exist at a more institutional or systemic level anywhere?
I'm most familiar with the Bay Area. So I know that in Oakland Unified, the district is trying to facilitate creativity. It's not punishing teachers who want to do things that are innovative. And, good school site administrators are facilitating that. They are creating the conditions where teachers can do new and novel things under this, you know, these constraints. I have a friend whose kid is in Pittsburgh Public Schools. And in response to kids saying, this is too much, you're giving us too much homework, there's too much work to do, the teachers and school community sat down and they said, okay, here's what we're going to do. Every Wednesday, we're going to pause academics. And it's going to be a half day, but you can come online and we're going to have all these different workshops and things that you can go to. You want to go and hang out with the seniors. Here's the room for the seniors. We have share pets, bring your pets. They had, dance and these are things that the teachers were a part of too, and the school staff was a part of too. They said, we're going to pause the academics because we hear you kids. And I think that that's happening too, is that, the good schools are trying to be responsive. They know that kids need a break and they need these spaces where the kids can be silly or have, you know, TikTok time and playing Among Us. I have student teachers that play Among Us with their kids as part of just kind of community building and a break from the normal school thing. That's happening. It's happening. You know, I don't know of districts that are kind of on that level, but there are certainly schools that are committed to that. Mission High School here in San Francisco, I know that that's happening. At the school that I taught at, Downtown High School, these are schools that are really, they're doing their best, and they know that to do their best, they're going to have to really kind of let go of some of the academic normal school stuff to give kids just the time to be together, to be silly, to explore, but to also learn some stuff. And I again, want to think that that's a little more frequent than not, and that the necessity of the pandemic has forced kind of a creativity and openness in more places than we think. And, you know, I'd ask parents to ask their kids if they have older kids, like, you know, what is your teachers doing anything cool or interesting or even silly? And you probably find a lot is happening that you otherwise wouldn't see.
Thank you for that, Kyle. Is there anything else that you would like to address that I haven't asked you about?
So I just generally really want us to be thinking about, you know, progressive people in particular, like how can we use this as an opportunity to really push for a new ways of doing school, of new ways of thinking of curriculum, of new ways of thinking of our relationships as between adults, between kids and kids, between kids and adults. How can we make schools more student-centered, more driven by student interest? How can we kind of break the wheel of this college and career juggernaut that we just all kind of have bowed down to and let dominate schools? How can we make schools more focused on actual learning and creating the experiences that are memorable, that stick with kids and with teachers and with families? How can we more meaningfully integrate families into the life of schools? And how can we broaden the purpose without saddling schools with the additional burdens of being the solution to all of America's social problems? I guess that's one last thing that I'd like for us to really think deeply about is how can we take some of these responsibilities that we've saddled schools with and build the institutions and entities that can do them better? Why are we relying on schools as the primary sites for the mental health and social well-being of young people? It's schools are nothing. And so schools can and should play a part in that, but we cannot rely on them exclusively to do that kind of, it's an absurd charge that no one can win at. You cannot ask schools to do more. They are doing everything that they absolutely can. And I want us to really be thinking about more broadly in society is how can we create the social conditions for everyone to thrive, for schools to be places where they aren't gauntlets to justify who gets to get a good job and who gets nothing. We need them to be places where people are developed and that people are allowed to pursue things that are interesting and rewarding. And how can we build a more solidaristic society with schools as a core feature of that society? And that's really what I want us to be thinking of in these conditions, is not a return to how schools were. We should be going, if and when teachers go back to in-person schooling, we should be saying, we're not going back to the way it was before. It's going to be different from now on. And this is how it's going to be different and why it's going to be different. The kids deserve more. So there's just been a lot of cynical deployment of kids of color in this that really upsets me, because this belief that what kids of color, particularly poor kids of color, need is more school, as school was. And we cannot allow ourselves again to let young people of color be deployed as weapons for that pre-COVID status quo. So if we're going to be saying that these kids are, quote, falling behind, or falling behind what? And is that falling behind a bad thing if catching up means like losing huge parts of who they are? I really want us to push back against this usage of kids of color as a justification for returning to the way that schools were. They deserve so much more because schools generally served them so poorly. You cannot expect the problem to magically become the solution all of a sudden without changing the relationship that thing had to those kids. We have to change it.
The questions that you posed, I thought were just really, really powerful, because it challenges the basic paradigm you know, of what is education for, who is it meant to serve, who does it not serve, and, you know, gets us out of that very narrow discussion about online versus in-person to really, it gets at the core questions. And also points out the opportunities that this pandemic offers. We think a lot about the limitations, but not so much about the opportunity to not go back and actually, you know, think about all of this and start doing things in a different way. And I also think your point was super important about the way that students of color have been actually used to reinforce an agenda or justify an agenda that just does more of the same. One of the things that strikes me is when you, you know, in a lot of issues, you can kind of see through the language which side people are on. So let's say on the gun rights, you know, gun control, gun rights debate, you kind of know after listening 20 seconds or so to somebody speak what kind of policies they're pushing and where they come down on that issue. But in education, one of the things that really strikes me is that all sides use the same rhetoric, right? It's all about, let's serve every student, you know, every student needs to learn. You know, our system isn't serving particularly students of color and low-income students. So everybody uses that kind of language of reform, but you have to dig deep to actually look at what are the policies that people are then doing with that rhetoric. And in many cases, it's, well, therefore we need more standardized testing. Therefore we need more standardized curriculum. Therefore we need to punish schools, you know, and teachers who aren't bringing up the test scores. You know, I mean, all this kind of range of things that are exactly the things that help to reproduce that inequity and injustice. So I just think you're right on point there to shine a light on that.
Thanks.
All right. Let me ask you finally, for those people who would like to learn more about these issues or get involved in supporting the fight for more equitable and socially just education, are there particular organizations or websites that you would suggest that they check out or join?
So there's kind of the Red for Ed movement, I think is a good place to start. Outside of the unions, there's the National Equity Project is doing good work. Care Ed out of USF. I know that you had Kevin Kumashiro on. So he's spearheading that. I think that in California, they're probably one of the more rightfully aggressive academic groups that's doing that. I get a lot of my education news from like the Hechinger Report.
Okay, good. Well, thank you so much, Kyle. This has been just inspiring, insightful, and I really appreciate you taking the time.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
Okay. Take care.